Hey everyone, welcome to Stutter Talk. I am Peter Reitzes, here with co-host Eric Jackson. Good morning, Eric.
Hey, buddy.
And our very special guest, Mr. Austin Pendleton. Good morning.
Hi, how are you all?
Hey, excited to be speaking to you. Austin Pendleton is an actor, writer, director, and teacher who has starred and acted in dozens of movies and television shows, Broadway and off-Broadway plays, has written plays, and teaches acting at the HB Studio and directing at the New School for Drama, both in Greenwich Village. Welcome to the show, Mr. Pendleton. Our first question for you is, what is your earliest memory of stuttering?
It was when I was about 8 or 9 years old. I come from Warren, Ohio, I was taken up to Cleveland to spend a few days with my cousins and my cousin Kate, whose name is now Kate Buttenweiser, and lives in Boston. She and I were hanging out with a bunch of kids, and they began to make fun of me for that, which I wasn't even aware I was doing. And she said, "Don't make fun of him." And that's I even remember where we were on the street when this happened.
So it's kind of like somebody else told you that you were a stutterer.
Yeah, right. I mean, it probably, people had been aware of it before then, but I somehow hadn't taken it in, I guess. I can't quite figure out what it was.
So, Mr. Pendleton, growing up, was stuttering a handicap?
Oh, yeah. What you've probably learned, what I've learned in the therapy that I've done, is that 3/4 of the people who have that problem as children, it falls away when they're about 12. But the other 25%, if it doesn't fall away, then after that it gets a lot worse in the teen years, which it did for me. And at that time, I'm 69 years old, so at that time it was the treatment for it was very people groping in the dark. Let's put it that way. And it was hard. There wasn't anyone to go to, really. But then when I came into New York, I began to study with a lot of. I became an actor, and I began to study with a lot of people who... I began to go to different people who trained actors in their speaking voices, as well as I began to study with a singing teacher. And all of that began to have an effect on it. And then, in 1981, I went to this therapist named... who now has an organization of her own by the name of Catherine Montgomery, who's in New York, you know, and she had a huge effect.
Yeah, we actually know Catherine well. I did an intensive program at the American Institute for Stuttering.
Oh, good. Yeah. Did you like it?
It was a life-changing experience for me, to say the least.
Oh, great. I mean, what are you telling me? Are you telling me it was productive for you?
Yes, it was completely productive for me.
Oh, that's wonderful.
One of the most helpful things was being around a bunch of other people who stutter.
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. She has such a wonderful kind of holistic attitude about the whole thing. That's great. Oh, I'm so glad you had that experience.
So,
please, so keep talking.
We have so many questions to ask you. We saw an Associated Press article about you, and the caption said, "Austin Pendleton, stuttering created a personal hell." Is that true? I mean, was that how bad it was?
Yeah, that would be, I'd forgotten that I said that, but yeah.
So how did you get from that to being a professional actor?
Well, somehow when I was in high school and when I was in college, I found that things went a lot better when I was acting, you know. So I just got, and also, I mean, acting itself really began to excite me, you know. And it wasn't just for that reason, you know. And it was that. And then the first role that I got in New York, as luck or lack of luck would have it, actually involved that in the character, you know. And that was really hard. That was really, really hard. And that was when I began to hit all those teachers.
Let's talk about acting a little bit. We saw a quote. You said, "I liked acting so much that I did not want my speech problem to dictate what I could and could not do. So I decided to battle with stuttering." So
yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how you did battle with stuttering and what you did to kind of face it?
Well, acting became sort of the conduit into dealing with it. It just began to... I became obsessive about that, and then that... See, what was good about that, that was a very specific way of challenging it. So I didn't have to challenge... I didn't have to think so much about challenging it in everyday life.
Right.
You know? So, I mean, I think my life would be now and would have been very different without acting. It's terrifying to confront it in your everyday life, you know what I mean?
Of course.
Somehow acting is such a specific way of, a specific way of challenging it.
We've heard through the grapevine that you've lost some professional opportunities because of your stuttering. Is that true? And could you talk a little bit?
You have heard this?
Yeah, I don't want to tell you who, but I know someone who took some classes with you, and they were telling me that they had heard you say that, but perhaps they misheard you.
Oh, I think I know what it was I said. I don't know of any. I could never prove that. No one has ever told me that. But I did know that I didn't get hired for a couple of years in any film or anything after I did My Cousin Vinny. And I always thought it had to do with that. In fact, I wish I'd never done that movie.
I remember the first time that I saw My Cousin Vinny, and it was kind of at an early age. I was watching it with my family and friends, and when the scene came up in which you played a lawyer, I kind of remember laughing along with everybody in the room, but at the same time, I felt really embarrassed because I was sitting in a room where everybody was laughing at this kind of incompetent lawyer who couldn't get his words out. How did you approach that particular scene, and was it hard for you?
Oh, I hated doing it. I just hated it. first of all, it was directed by an old friend of mine. And I told him I didn't want to do it, and then he came to New York, and he had to come to New York anyway, and he came to New York, and he took me out to a Greek restaurant. We emptied, I think, a couple of bottles of Retsina. We spent a few hours together. I'd loved the script, and I even thought that the use of that in the script was very inventive. It never occurred to me that people who have this problem or have feelings about this problem would be offended by it. Because I wasn't offended by it, and certainly I've had a lot of struggle with it in my life. I thought it was as if the kind of comedy, the kind of dark comedy that movie is, I thought it would be as if they kept promising there would be an eyewitness to clear the guys, and then he would walk in with a seeing eye dog. I didn't think that would be offensive to blind people. You know, it just did. I thought the use of it was really quite inventive and funny. And I also loved the way that the character was just serenely unaware that this would be a problem. I didn't think that was a comment about that particular affliction. I just thought that thing that people, and certainly I know actors like this, sometimes I myself think I'm an actor like this, where you just are serenely unaware that you're totally unfit for a certain role, and you go on as if it's going to, like, work. I thought it was a terrific, I just didn't want to do it. And so then I did it, and of course it was painful to do. It was like going back to my the worst moments of my adolescence and early 20s. And I, but then when there was an outcry, well, two things happened. First of all, the film was so popular and still is, yeah, and deservedly popular, I think. I think it's a terrific movie. But I didn't expect it to be that popular. When I read the script, I thought it was offbeat, and I thought that would keep it from being like a huge, like a classic in the popular imagination. But then it was, and to this day, people come up and describe the character that way to me, and that say that that's the thing they will remember me by, which does not make me happy. And so that, but then also there was, finally, actually Catherine Montgomery got some calls about it when it came out from an organization out in California about that, and who were very offended by it. And she finally said, Austin, you've got to call them. The calls just, they keep calling me about it. So I called and I had this long talk with this guy, and I explained to him some of the things I just explained to you, and he said, well, I said, I'm very sorry if I've caused people offense. Whereupon he said, we have a newsletter, and one thing you can do about that is you can write an apology to our newsletter for having done the movie. I said, no, wait a minute. I'm an artist. I don't apologize for what I do. No, I'm not going to. And I think it's, and I said, he and I were having a friendly talk, so I didn't get harsh with him, but I said, I think it's very wrong of them. I didn't say of you, talking to him, you know. Mm-hmm. I said, I think it's very wrong of them to ask for an apology for this. This is a perfectly legitimate role in a perfectly legitimate movie. I think it's paranoid for them to think that it was intended to make fun of people with this problem. And I'm certainly not going to apologize for it. And if I suppose I would maybe an apology if I blundered into a film somehow that advocated the resurrection of the Nazi Party, I might apologize for that.
Right.
But I mean, come on. And he said, I totally understand. I'm only passing on what they said. And in fact, I agree with you. And in fact, toward the end of the, this is a long conversation one Saturday night. At the end of it, he said, I have to confess something. I don't know what they're so upset about either. I said, well, no, now I'm going to backtrack a little. I understand why they're upset, but not as upset as this. I mean, it just to tell them to take a deep breath and think about it. It's not, that's not the point of it, what they're saying. And then I repeated what I just now said to you about that. But then about, quite a while after that, I got a package of mail from 20th Century Fox, who had released the film, and they said, we think you ought to read this. And there were all these angry letters that people had written to Fox over the past few months since the movie had come out about, you know, how offended they were by the use of that with that character. And of course, 3/4 of them hadn't even seen the movie. So, you know, you can't. I mean, what are you going to say? I hear that there's a scene where this guy stutters and people laugh, and I'm appalled you would release such a movie and all that. Well, go see the movie. I mean, come on, you know? And then there were some other stutters by people who had seen it who got all, I thought, self-righteous about it. And it ventured in an area of political correctness, which I think is not entirely irrelevant to an artistic process, but you have to be very careful with it. Then there was a letter from a 12-year-old boy in Canada, which shattered me, where he said he was having trouble with it, severe trouble with this, and he sat in the movie and heard the whole audience howling with laughter, and he was just humiliated and mortified, and that really got to me. So it took me 1 year to figure out how to answer him. So finally, and I kept putting it off, I just couldn't think of a way to answer it. Finally, I wrote him a letter, a long letter, and I said, look, I've had this problem too. One very good thing to do about this is to learn to have a sense of humor about it. And I suppose if I had thought through fully why I did the film, other than I didn't go into the bottle of Ritzina and everything, that would be a thing to, it's like anything, it's a, think of it as a human foible. And if you think of it that way, so will everyone you deal with. And then within 2 weeks, I got a long letter back from his mother saying, thank you so much for that letter. That has changed his whole attitude about everything. He used to sit absolutely quiet in school and would never say anything. Now they can't shut him up. And so that was a very good thing that came out of that. And so we corresponded for just a little while after that. And so that was the most personally dramatic thing that came out of that whole experience for me.
Now, I saw the film when I was a child. It was one of the films that got played often on HBO and cable, and
it still gets played all the time on television.
Yeah, and I
wish they would stop.
I would have to leave the room, not because I was offended, but because I, at the time, I wasn't able to deal with my own stuttering, and it was so painful. I mean, like, the character you played was my worst nightmare. Like, being
yeah,
in the public
eye. And one thing the director said to me that night when he was plying me with wine, he's an old friend of mine. I'd known him at that time for 25 years. He would been an English actor, and he had played the part in London that I had played in New York in Fiddler on the Roof, and that's how we got to know each other. And then he became a director in the theater and then a film director. But one thing, and I respect him very highly as both an actor and a director and as a friend, and he said to me that evening in the restaurant, look, what other actor would know this the way you do? And the character's denial about it,
yeah,
is just, it's a function of the fact that it's a nightmare for him.
That's what was so tough, is that at the time, like now, if I were that lawyer, I would just say, by the way, I'm a person who stutters.
Yeah.
But to see you struggle and to act in all the ways that I had acted, like, you did something that was great, and I don't even know if you remember it, but after you spoke to the jury in the movie, you were using these secondaries, you were pushing, almost spitting out your words, and you were clearly, as a lawyer, not prepared. And as you walked away from the jury, you sort of waved to the judge, like almost apologizing for existing.
Yeah.
And as a stutterer, I knew, I've done that, where you come off as a buffoon and you do something like that wave. Like, do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, very well. But that kind of, actually, when I did that in one of the takes, and then Jonathan asked me to keep it in the subsequent takes, that kind of was when I kind of, when the character came together for me.
Now, how much of that character was you at some point in your life?
Well, in my teen years, it was almost like a documentary of my teen years, although when I played it, I was in my early 50s. But it was like a return, as you say. It was like a return to the bad times of being in this. I mean, if I hadn't already had 10 years under my belt after having worked with Catherine Montgomery, I don't think three bottles of Ritzina would have gotten me into that film.
Yeah, I'm...
Please, go
there. There it is, awkward stuttering moment. Yeah. No, I'm really glad that you brought up the element of humor in there. It's such a tricky line.
Yeah, because, yes, it is. Yeah.
Because Peter and I certainly know the, and a lot of other people certainly know the value in having fun with stuttering, and that has helped us both tremendously with this thing.
Well, it's the best known antidote to any kind of shame.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you shared the story about the boy from Canada, because it does just go to show you that if you make a comment like that, some people will get it. But how can we, you know, get children to believe that, hey, it's okay to laugh about this thing?
Yeah. And if they begin to do that early, before they build up all these habits of thinking about it, then that those layers of shame, which are virtually unconscious at that age, well, not unconscious, but they aren't labeled as such, you know, by the kid. Those won't get a chance to build up. See, I think that's where a lot of the damage is done, in those early years when the kid builds up layers and layers of shame. And if that could be headed off at the pass, you know what I mean? Which is part of the reason I think that AIS, that Catherine works with so many people who are young. I think she goes as early as 8 years old or something like that.
Yeah. So you've been a recipient of the Artime Award. The Artime Theater Company is a theater company for children and teens who stutter. What do you think, like, when you see all those young people singing and dancing and stuttering on stage, what do you think of that?
At the Artime thing, you say?
Yeah.
I think it's great, because I think what he's trying to do with Artime, what's his name? Taro Alexander. Yeah, I couldn't remember his first name. I think what he's trying to do is he's trying to confront the shame problem head on at fundraisers with lots and lots of people there with lots of money and fame and everything. He has them get up at first to speak to the crowd, and it's gotten to be quite a large crowd at those annual things, and then to sing. I mean, I think that's incredibly intelligent of him.
Yeah.
The Stuttering 101 podcast by Stutter Talk features lecture-like discussions with leading researchers and therapists in the field of stuttering. Episodes have discussed the topics of stuttering onset, measuring public attitudes about stuttering, effective communication, successful therapy outcomes, integrating speech tools, the role of genetics in stuttering, and much, much more. Guests have included Dr. Dennis Drena from the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Scott Yaris from the Stuttering Center of Western Pennsylvania, Lee Caggiano, the director of Friends, Dr. Philip Schneider, who wrote, directed, and produced the film Transcending Stuttering, The Inside Story, and many, many more. Check Stuttering 101 out at stuttering101.com.
This is Jamie Rocchio. You know, Eric and Peter have provided us with well over 125 episodes of Stutter Talk and Stuttering 101. And man, if you enjoyed these shows as much as I do, then let's think about giving back. guys put in many long hours as well as thousands of dollars putting these podcasts together. Let's help them to continue the good work and offset some of their costs by making a donation. They make it real easy with PayPal right on their website. So let's say thanks, guys, by reaching in our pockets and giving what you can. Trust me, it'll feel great. Just go to their website at stuttertalk.com, and right under the play button, you'll see a nice sign says donate. Give it a click, then you can take it from there.
Hey, this is John Melendez from The Tonight Show, and you're listening to Stutter Talk. Really good show, but, you know, it takes a long time to get to the point.
We're not going to say anyone's name, but there are quite a few of your colleagues in the field of acting who are well known and who stutter, who aren't like you, who don't speak out, who don't give the interviews. What do you think of famous people?
I think they're very smart.
You do? No, but serious, why?
I do, because as I say, with my cousin Vinny, it was like the dirty, well, all of the interviews you're talking about were before that. So my cousin Vinny, what had been a sort of tacit agreement that nobody ever said, I'm not ever to talk about that in terms of me, all of a sudden there I was smearing it all over screens all over the world in a very popular motion picture. And as I say, I would go for a film interview for 2 years after that, every time I went in. If the director said, I really liked you, my cousin Vinny, it was virtually code for the fact that no matter how well I read today, I was not going to get the part.
But is that because of stuttering or because...
Yes. That must have been what I was referring to in class when that former student of mine had mentioned this. Because it was all but explicit. Now, I don't know which particular jobs happen. I mean, sometimes you just don't get the part. It's not for that reason. But it can't have been a coincidence. So I don't know which of those jobs I lost because of that, but I know it has to have been some of them.
Now, you act on Broadway, and you act in many plays. Does your stuttering ever become part of your character?
Yeah. It's happened over the years, kind of less and less and less and less and less and less and less, because now I have all these tools that I learned either from Catherine or from the voice teachers, you know, that I've worked with as an actor. And also just the more you do it, the more it tends to fall away. Occasionally there are little exceptions to that. But earlier in my career, pre-Catherine, it would creep into the performances and people would allude to it. But I always tried to make it, I didn't consciously try to make it part of the character, but I would just try to get so immersed in the character, the audience would just think, well, this is one of the things the character does.
You were kind of joking before, Mr. Pendleton, about all of the other actors who kind of don't speak about stuttering out there in the limelight.
Yeah.
Do you think, though, that an actor, someone who has recognition in that sphere, do you think them speaking about stuttering or stuttering openly in front of a lot of people like that would be positive for a lot of children to see?
Yes. And yet I understand why they would be reluctant to do it.
Yeah.
Because this industry, this is true of a whole lot of industries, but it's certainly true of the acting industry. They literally think of reasons to not hire you. So to actually start handing the reasons to them can really kind of blow up in your face. Well, I mean, I understand all sides of the dilemma. I agree with what you're saying. I think it would be very helpful. So, a person who has written about it in his autobiography is James Earl Jones.
Yeah, he writes about it, but it's one thing to write about it. It's something else to stand up in front of children and talk about stuttering, or in front of people who stutter.
You know who's starting to talk about it is Emily Blunt.
Yes, yes.
I think it's see James Earl Jones, whom I slightly know, and like what, he's a profoundly decent man, and of course he's a great actor. He belongs to the generation that I do. He's older than I am, but we're basically the same generation. And when he was coming of age as an actor, you just would never mention that. I mean, it would have ended the career. But now the atmosphere Emily's coming into, where in effect everything is so public. And she's a girl. Talk about a girl with a sense of humor. That's her. And she's already like acted with Meryl Streep, and she has very impressive credits. So I think people of her generation are going to feel freer and freer to talk about it. Now, also part of that is going to have been due to Catherine's work, because what I emailed Meryl Streep and asked her if I could get Emily Blunt's email address from her, and say now, and I told her why, and I said, you know, that AIS wanted to make her an honoree. Now I said to Meryl, if you feel awkward about this, I totally understand. And she Emily said, oh, here it is, ask her. And we did, and she jumped right in, and she came to the fundraiser and gave a long speech, and which was extremely moving and funny. And she's now, I think she's joined the board of AIS. So she's put herself in the line to be a spokesperson for it, you see.
You know, here's the thing, and I really don't want to come across as a jerk. I love the fact that she's doing that. But my understanding is that she's not stuttering openly. And I think it's really tough because we want role models for people
who
stutter.
Well, no, I mean, she did, and she can certainly talk about that.
Right, but the role models we have tend to be people who stand up and talk about when they used to stutter. But it's different when you actually hear people stutter. So,
well, are you saying she should get in front of them and do that?
Yeah, I'm saying that it's tough. I don't want to come across as ungrateful, because I'm not. But, you know, I'm not sure if the best role model for children who stutter are adults who stutter who don't show their stuttering. Because what's the message?
What that means is that they've worked very hard. They've worked on it very hard, which shows that a kid with that doesn't need to feel hopeless about it. I would think. I mean, couldn't that be a way of looking at it?
You know what? You're right. And again, I don't want to be ungrateful. I always remember this time I was at a presentation like the one we're talking about, and a mother leaned over to her son and said, "Someday you can stutter like he's stuttering." And I turned to my buddy and said, "But the speaker's not stuttering." Like, so, I mean, I think it sets a model up of, well, she's not stuttering or he's not stuttering, you can do that too. And sometimes it's just not that easy, or seeing the forest through the trees is hard. And it's a mixed blessing, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's by no means are we saying that people in the limelight are required to stutter openly. I strongly believe that, and they do get up there and speak about their past struggles with stuttering. Certainly, I think children can, in some way, identify with that. I guess what we're saying is it's kind of it's it it may be more powerful if a kid actually sees a person stuttering, and as a result says to themselves afterwards, well, it really is okay to stutter.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not that like they're concealing it. It's that when they're talking, that doesn't, right, they have more control over it. It's not like they're hiding it, because you can't hide it. If it starts to happen, you can't hide it. I don't think Emily Blunt, I mean, I hardly know her. I've met her a couple of times now through AIS. But I don't think that she, if it started to happen to her while she was addressing people, she would have no choice but to let it happen. But she would let it happen, you know?
Mr. Pendleton, do you have time for just a few more questions?
Sure, sure.
We love to ask our guests how they view stuttering. Do you view your own stuttering as a handicap, as a gift, or something else?
I view it as a handicap and a gift. Do you want me to try to explain that?
Yeah, please.
Well, it is a handicap, and as I said, that long night, that long talk with a guy in California, I said, come on, I don't think we use that word, but some word like that, and he questioned that. I said, of course it's a handicap. What are you talking about? I mean, it's like, who would not prefer to not do that? I mean, now, if we can just accept that, then we can look at the ways in which it is a gift. I mean, but it's like, I think there should be like anything, I think there should be an acceptance of it by the people who do that and the people who are around them. There should be a full acceptance of it, and there should also be a striving away from it, which the striving will be much easier if it's rooted in an acceptance of it and not a hysterical fear of and revulsion about it. Just an acceptance of it. It does get in the way sometimes. Just, I mean, as simple a statement as that. It's not horrifying. It's not disgusting. It doesn't represent the person being a failure. It does not characterize the person even. But it is a difficult thing for them. First of all, it's physically painful. I mean, who wants that?
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera. It does get in the way sometimes in certain moments. It does make things hard that other people completely take for granted. So just say, okay, this is a handicap. Now, a whole lot of people in the world are handicapped in different ways. And then if they say, okay, this is a handicap, it's my lot in life. If people have lots in life that aren't in any way handicaps that are audible or visible like that. Things that keep them from being able to behave exactly, pretty much the way they want to at every given moment. And having things available and accessible to them that they would like to have available. That's all I mean by a handicap. If you either get crazy about it or then insist on saying it's beautiful, well, okay, saying it's beautiful is an option, and if somebody wants to do that, okay, that's fine. But I think just saying, okay, this is a handicap, it's my lot in life, there are much worse ones, and in certain ways it is a gift. Now, I can only talk as an actor, because as I say, that's the medium through which I have particularly thought about it and dealt about it over the years, which has helped me to contain my struggle with it. Now, and that is that when you have this problem, one of your main hopes. Well, here's what a voice teacher said to me once, as an acting voice teacher. Speaking voice. He said, "Look, you have to think of inhaling the other person's lines and exhaling your own," which is actually, apart from everything else, one of the best one sentence definitions of acting that I've ever heard. And I teach that all the time. And so when you have this problem as an actor, which, by the way, of course, doesn't ever completely go away, and it never goes away as a possibility, as a thing that could happen. But if you really get committed to the role you're playing and you really pay attention to the person you're acting with, and you really take them in the high crisis type situations that any play or movie is about, it doesn't tend to happen as often, or if it does happen, it doesn't get in the way, because it's happening within the context of a total connection with the other actor. It's not an impediment to the flow, but even if it happens. It grows organically out of the connection with the other person. It doesn't isolate you from the other person. So that, well, just in terms of, I'll just speak in terms of acting, that improves your acting. It also, when you start to learn that in acting, it improves your personal life.
How?
If every response you do is virtually an exhale in response to not only what the other person is saying, but how they're looking at you, what the vibe you're getting from them and all that, it keeps you very connected to and engaged with other people. And that makes it a gift. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes total sense.
Yeah. But it's like any handicap. It's like you get certain insights into the world and you get to develop certain kinds of connections with other people in the world. In just everyday interactions and on a deeper level too than you would have maybe if you did not have this, let's just call it a problem.
Okay.
Use as neutral a word as that. Just a problem, that's all.
Sure.
It's no more or less than that. So when I say it's been a handicap, and it is a handicap, and it's a gift, and it's been a gift, and still is a gift. That's what I mean.
In the stuttering world, we often talk about, should we talk to our colleagues at work about stuttering? Should we tell our graduate students that we stutter? As a director, and as a teacher, do you tell your students and your colleagues that you stutter? Do you think that's important to talk to them about it?
Do I tell them what, did you say?
That you stutter. Do you bring up your stuttering with your colleagues and your students?
Well, first of all, they can tell anyway. I don't even have to bring it up. But then sometimes I will bring it up. Yeah, just so in case, so it doesn't hang in the room like the elephant in the room that everybody's afraid to mention. And then I find when I do bring it up, and I try to do it in a way that's kind of light, you know, it's amazing how it opens them up on the subject. They feel free to talk about it then.
Yeah. We know some people who have been through your classes, and they just say that you're the best, nicest teacher that they've had. Do you think that growing up stuttering plays some part in how you approach acting and teaching?
Yeah, of course it does. Yeah. I've never met a stutterer who was not nice. I'm sure there are such people.
Yeah, I've met a couple.
But I've never met one who wasn't extremely nice. I mean, I think it is, let's just call it a condition. It's a humbling condition.
Yeah.
And whatever kind of arrogance you have, the arrogance is still there, but it doesn't come out as much behaviorally. I mean, everybody's arrogant about something or another, you know. But the arrogance, it seems, doesn't happen in everyday behavior as much.
It comes out a little bit though. I remember when I started making changes and went to speech therapy and self-help, I thought I was unstoppable. I mean, just going straight up to people like, "Hey, I stutter. What's your name?"
I've never done that. But see, I'm from a different era than you.
Yeah.
In the 1950s, this was the wasteland. There was no such thing as a support group. There was not even any remotely reliable therapy. And there were all kinds of theories about it, that you were neurotic and all that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And it was, you had unresolved issues about this or that, and that's why, you know, all this, because they had no idea what to do, and it was this man called Ron Webster at Hollins College in Virginia who was just a regular speech teacher there who had a couple of students who had this problem, and then he just began to research it scientifically. And he started to evolve the program that's the first program that Catherine Montgomery got. I'm sure you know all this. He was the one who helped Annie Glenn, the wife of John Glenn, you know.
Yeah.
And he was the first person where he really began to open up a different way of looking at it. The first one that I ever heard of, and I was always trying to find someone who did. And I read about him in People magazine one day in line at the supermarket. So I went and called Virginia, and I said, I made an appointment to come down there. Then I couldn't come down there because I got a job here in New York. And they said, well, you know, we do have a place in New York, if that's where you're calling from. And so I went, and that's how I met Catherine. But anyway, until Ron Webster, when he began working, I think, in 1973 or something, it was basically a wasteland. So I grew up with a whole... In the era that I grew up in, you wouldn't dream of going up and saying to somebody, hello, I'm this, I stutter. You just wouldn't dream of it, which, of course, is neurotic and hopeless, and I admire you for doing that. And you know what? I have to go teach my class now.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us at Stutter Talk. We really appreciate it.
Oh, this has been wonderful. And if you want to do it again sometime, just email me, okay?
Hey, could you give us a quick promo, like, hey, this is Austin Pendleton, and you're listening to Stutter Talk?
Hey, this is Austin Pendleton, and you're listening to Stutter Talk.
Thanks, Mr. Pendleton.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, have a good day.
All right. Sir.